Thank you for your practice. It makes me really happy to be here. I'm particularly enjoying this retreat for some reason. So I'm really happy that you're here and appreciating your investigation and your reflections on your practice. So thank you. So, some questions. When I don't resist drifting mind, it feels pleasant. If I'm aware of that, is it skillful? I would say generally our kind of guide is, are we aware? So that's the first thing we check into. What's happening? Am I aware of it? And it doesn't matter what it is. There's certain states of mind that we may habitually tend to become not mindful in. I think I mentioned that earlier. Certain states of mind that we might think it's not possible to be mindful in. And yet, that belief can be popped, that view of, which is a delusion, I can't be mindful in some state. Like, if you ever have the thought, I'm too sleepy to be mindful, I'm too dull to be mindful, I'm too tired to be mindful, I'm too spacey to be mindful, I'd like to propose that if you have enough awareness to think that thought, you have enough awareness to be aware of the state. And so, you know, potentially see if you can shift that perception, that perspective. We can be mindful of anything, any state. Maybe except for non-mindfulness. But non-mindfulness is not inherent in any particular state of mind. It is something that happens based on conditions. Mindfulness vanishes based on conditions. Mindfulness re-arises based on conditions. But within any particular state of mind, mindfulness can be there, including drifting mind, including sleepy mind, dull mind, spaciness. And so the awareness, the kind of recognition, oh, the mind is drifting and there's the pleasantness. And this kind of recognition, at times we can recognize with something like spaciness or sleepiness or drifting mind, often there can be a pleasant quality, and it is the attitude of thinking it shouldn't be like that that creates the experience of unpleasantness. And so that's an important recognition with this observation. When I don't resist drifting mind, it feels pleasant. That can be very true. It can be true when I don't resist sleepiness, it can be pleasant. It is this idea that it's not okay, potentially, to have drifting mind in meditation or not okay to have sleepy mind in meditation. That view added onto the experience, that's where the unpleasantness is created. It's not necessarily in the state itself. And so if I'm aware of that, is it skillful? I'd probably need a little more conversation to fully determine whether it's skillful, because we can definitely kind of sink into the pleasantness of drifting mind. But the awareness, if you are aware of it, yes, that's skillful. Aware of it with curiosity, oh, this is pleasant drifting mind, as opposed to being aware of it, it's like, oh yeah, this is really pleasant, I think I'll hang out here for all day. So, you know, there's different ways that we can be aware of of things. As Sayadaw said, awareness alone is not enough. It does need this wisdom to infuse it in order to carry us in the direction of freedom, in order for the learning and understanding to grow that helps the mind to let go of clinging. And so it's useful with this kind of experience, noticing drifting mind, noticing the pleasant, noticing the awareness of it. Check the relationship. Check the attitude. Maybe there's a little bit of leaning in, a little bit of, ooh, that feels good. Well, maybe that's a little bit of greed. And so that being known, okay, there's drifting pleasantness and I like it. That's what's happening. That's skillful. And so, you know, we learn the checking of the attitude can reveal, you know, subtler and subtler levels of leaning in, subtler and subtler levels of tarrying and hurrying, we can say. It's not always the real obvious things. I hate that. Go away. It can be just the subtlest. Ooh, what's that? With just this, like, a little bit of latching onto. So close to the experience of interest that we don't quite recognize a little tinge of greed that's with it. And yet, you know, this process unfolds in a kind of a staged fashion, or it may be that there's a little bit of greed or excitement or leaning in as we see some things for the first time and really kind of like, wow, that is so amazing. You know, there can be a little bit of greed in there. And yet what's happening there is also that the interest is growing and that the mind is learning about a different way of connecting with experience. And so a phrase that the Buddha used at times is, by relying on this, abandon that. I may elaborate on this a little later in the retreat, but just as a kind of a basic sense of this, by relying on something wholesome, interest and investigation, for instance, we can begin to let go of something more unwholesome. And in that relying on that wholesome quality, there may be some clinging and some greed in there, but it is helping us to let go of something that is more unskillful. And so by relying on this, abandon that. And then at some point, the that is more abandoned and the this is what's here, and we begin to feel or taste or sense the suffering that's in the relying, which may have some clinging in it. We may begin to taste the clinging in that relying on, feel the suffering of that. And that is when we really need to kind of take in or be curious about, well, what is happening there? Sometimes we can explore letting suffering guide us in this. And so in this kind of a question, you know, when I don't resist drifting, it feels pleasant and I'm aware of that. Is there any suffering in this? Are you experiencing the mind at ease and balance? Does it feel a little bit like it's tumbling forward, trying to keep it? What's happening in conjunction with this state? And if it feels balanced, it's skillful. So there's not just a kind of a cut and dried answer to this question, but I think the gist of it is, when you are aware, you know, check the attitude. And if you have a question like this, I'm aware of this, is this skillful? Check the relationship, check the attitude. And attitudes can be subtle. So sometimes they are subtler than we're seeing at the moment. But if what you're seeing is basically, yeah, seems okay. Maybe you're not seeing a subtle leaning in or a subtle holding on to something. That's okay. It will reveal itself at some point. Maybe it will reveal itself in the next sitting when you find yourself trying to find that place of enjoying drifting again and not able to do it. You may then at that point realize, oh, there might have been some clinging last time. And yet now is when you're suffering around it. So now is when to look at that suffering around that situation. Another question that has a similar flavor. I could see attention jumping from experience to experience. I thought it was wandering mind, but I noticed I was aware. What's happening there? So this kind of experience seems to come in this style of practice, or maybe it happens more generally as we shift from a more focused practice to a more open practice. This experience of the mind kind of not being on one experience, the breath, or maybe just in the body, but noticing it kind of feels like, oh, there's a sound and then a body sensation and then a breath and then a thought and then a body sensation and then a sound. And it feels kind of chaotic. It can feel kind of chaotic. It might feel jumpy. The quality of that might feel kind of jumpy. Or it might feel like it's just shifting really quickly from one thing to another. And this experience of the mind shifting, and the attention is really here, what's happening. The attention is shifting from experience to experience. This experience of the attention shifting, when we're unfamiliar with it, can feel a little bit odd. If we're used to landing on one experience and staying there, this experience of shifting from thing to thing can feel kind of a chaotic. And so we might interpret it as not being mindful because maybe we have kind of unwittingly maybe associated that stability of one experience with the mindfulness. And so this is something that we really begin to recognize, that the mindfulness can be stable, or the awareness can be stable, and objects can be coming and going in that awareness. And initially, as we touch into that kind of experience, it feels pretty pretty odd. The first time I got the instruction from the Mahasi style practice of object-oriented practice to shift from the focused attention to noting whatever comes up, noting whatever arises. When I first let go of the breath and just tried to note what arose, it just felt like insanity. And so quickly I was kind of like, oh, go back to the breath. That's a little, oh, I don't know that I can handle that. That feels a little insane. And so I began to do what I called a focused open awareness practice, where I started with the breath, and I had the breath. I always had the breath there. It was like, okay, breath and hearing, breath and body sensation, breath and sound, breath and thought, so that it was like there was a it was like I had a tether to that. And so that helped me initially in that experience. But this experience of that feeling, or so in this case, it's great the recognition. So noticing attention's jumping from experience to experience, and then thought it was wandering mind, but then noticed that you were aware. That's kind of the ground that we come back to. Are you aware? It doesn't matter what we are aware of, or whether that experience stays for half a second, or we are landing on it for a minute. The awareness is kind of our guide. The awareness is what helps us to recognize, okay, this is the practice is unfolding. The practice is being cultivated. Awareness is being cultivated. And so what is happening, the question here, what is happening here? Basically, you're starting to recognize, in that kind of a place, you're starting to recognize that the attention shifts from experience to experience. Sometimes the attention will stay with one thing for a little longer time. Sometimes, and there are different kind of conditions in our meditation, sometimes the attention just kind of is more interested in roaming around. And so it's not a problem. It's more you're seeing that this is a way that the mind can work. Sometimes, I'm going to speak a little bit about this more tomorrow, talk more about awareness tomorrow. But this question kind of leads into it. Sometimes when we are in awareness, knowing what's happening, it can feel like we're knowing many things at the same time. And sometimes it feels more like time slicing. Like it might be a breath and then a sound and then another half of the breath and then the sound again and then a body sensation and then back to the half of the breath. And it's almost like you're seeing the attention kind of time slicing these various experiences. So you're getting like a little snip of the breath and then a little piece of the sound and then a little snip of the breath and then a little piece of the sound. Sometimes we can see the mind doing that kind of time slicing. That tends to happen more when we have been doing an object-based focused practice, an object practice, more the Mahasi style of practice, where we kind of land on an object and really kind of let the attention almost sink into the object. And then another experience happens, and because that's the way we're cultivating the attention, it sinks into the next object. And that other object is like gone for that split second. And then the attention sinks into another object. And so it's got this kind of discrete quality of object after object after object. That's one way that attention can function. And that style of practice, the object-oriented practice of really attuning to the qualities of the object or the experience, that tends to create more that quality, or can create that quality of the attention feeling like it's jumping and time slicing from experience to experience. Other times, and more I'd say in this style of practice, is where I've seen this happen. The style of practice where we're more maybe a little more interested in the awareness itself rather than so focused on the qualities of the object. We're interested in awareness is happening. And from that perspective, the experience of awareness, it can have this quality of moving, shifting from experience to experience. It can have a quality of being jumpy from experience to experience or flowing from experience to experience, but it also can just feel like I know a lot of things at the same time. It's not like there's a time slicing at all. It's like at the same time, there's the experience of an in-breath and the sensation of warmth of the sun on my cheek. At the same time, it doesn't feel like there's any shifting of the attention. Multiple experiences known simultaneously. That's the experience. So sometimes coming from the Mahasi approach or the object-focused approach, we might have the view or idea, partly because the training emphasizes this, that we can only be aware, the attention can only be with one thing at a time. And so then we almost discount this experience of feeling like there's multiple things happening simultaneously, like I know multiple things happening at the same time. Sometimes people will say, that's not really clear mindfulness, because I'm not just knowing one thing at a time. But that kind of experience can be almost a hallmark of a continuous awareness in this form of practice. And it's like that continuity of mindfulness is taking in a different context of experience. It's taking in the more global kind of experience, the context of where I am, what I'm doing, what's happening, how I'm engaging. It can know thoughts and how they're affecting me and how I'm acting out of that all at the same time, kind of the level of engagement that we might have in the world. Very stable mindfulness, knowing many things at the same time. So there is this teaching in the Abhidhamma that says that in a mind moment, in a moment of consciousness and feeling and perception all coming together in one mind moment, there will only be attention on one thing at a time. So this is an Abhidhamma teaching. And I've certainly kind of used that to criticize myself for not seeing one object at a time. But we need to recognize and understand the whole context of that teaching, which is what a mind moment is said to be in the Abhidhamma teaching. And a single mind moment is so vanishingly small. It is said there are 17 trillion in the blink of an eye. And so in the blink of an eye, 17 trillion possible different objects can be experienced. Mostly, we are not seeing things at that speed. And so the experience, what we are experiencing, feels like multiple things at the same time. I don't know if there are 17 trillion mind moments in the blink of an eye. I don't know if this kind of time slice is really what's going on in the mind. I've not seen that personally. That is in the teachings and the texts, and I think there are some people even in current day. Pao Ox Sayadaw has a kind of practice which really concentrates the mind and is said to be able to see these mind moments. So I think it may be possible. And yet, when I look at what the suttas teach, when I look at what the Buddha taught, it was very experiential. It feels like the Buddha was more interested in helping us to understand what's your experience, whatever level it is, not overlaying some concept of some theory onto experience and trying to see experience in that way. What is your experience? Trust that. And so if you're seeing experience in this kind of jumping from experience to experience, that's what you're noticing. That's one way that attention can be seen, one way that we can see attention functioning. It's not the only way. And so it's often interesting to kind of take care with, sometimes when we see something clearly for the first time, like this, wow, you know, the mind is just jumping from thing to thing, one thing at a time, we might get the idea, because it has so much clarity, that that's the reality, and that's what I'm supposed to be seeing. But that's one way that reality can be known, can be seen. And so take it in, experience it, recognize it as this is how the mind is functioning right now. But maybe hold off on reifying it as that's the way reality is. I don't think the Buddha reified reality in that way. He talked about what is the experience, what is the perception, and invited us to see how are we perceiving experience. I actually don't think he was so interested in what's the actual reality out there. He was more interested in what's the reality of experience. So that's what we're looking at. And anytime we kind of create some idea of, oh, that's what I'm supposed to be seeing. Well, okay, you know, set that aside for a little while. It's like, okay, well, what's the next thing that happens to be seen? Trust your experience. Trust when you're aware. It's like, trust that it is not a mistake, whatever it is. And then we do have to take care with the knowing when we can settle back and, yeah, oh, this is what's happening, versus when the mind is getting caught and pulled into the rabbit hole of something, and when we need to use some skills to balance the mind again. Another question. And a little bit, there's a kind of follow-on from what this just last question spoke to. What is the difference between this practice and open awareness practice? This practice is an open awareness practice. There are different ways we can be taught open awareness practice. There's a different kind of meditation technologies around open awareness practice. And so, you know, partly without a conversation here, it's a little hard to tease apart how you're defining open awareness practice. But I have some thoughts. I mean, I have certainly as I just mentioned, when I first learned open awareness practice, it was out of the Mahasi practice, out of the noting practice. So paying attention to the breath, stabilizing the mind on the breath. I was taught you have to be with the breath for a full hour without interruption before you shift to noting whatever arises. And that was the language that they used in the monastery with Saito Upandita, note whatever arises. And so the focus of that particular practice is on the objects. The tuning of the mind, the tuning of the attention is towards the qualities of the object, the characteristics of the object. the rapid increase of pressure on the in-breath, the pause and then the release of pressure on the out-breath, those kind of qualities. That's what the attention was joining to. The qualities of pitch and tone and sound, the wavering quality of hearing. The quality of the object was really where the mind was learning how to attend. Not so much in this case, in the initial practice in, is not so much with the object, with the awareness of the object, although that can happen over time, that we move into that. But so with the Mahasi practice, the instructions, okay, stay with the breath. If the attention goes off of the breath, note that, come back to the breath. But then at some point when the attention gets more concentrated and stable, the instructions are, okay, let go of the breath. You don't have to stay with the breath anymore. Just note what's arising. And that can, the experience can be very like what was just described in that last one, this jumpy quality from thing to thing. Like this is arising and that's arising. And the mind is knowing the qualities of those objects. It's like a sound popping in and vanishing, a body sensation popping in and vanishing. And the mind knows the quality of the object. So that is a way towards open awareness, object-based. This practice is less object-based. But still, it's an open awareness practice. And so, you know, the general drift with open awareness practice is that we are not consciously deciding what we are paying attention to. So that's the case as in the Mahasi method, they instructed us to let go of the breath and just note what arises. It was basically letting go of that intentionality to control where the attention is landing, letting go of the intentionality for the attention to be landing on the breath, and just like notice where the attention lands. And so you let go of that intentional control. And so I would say that's a general description, that letting go of the intentional control of attention is a general description of open awareness practice, but it can feel very different. The ways in can feel different depending on whether the emphasis is on noticing the object or noticing the awareness itself. And so then there's other open awareness practices that actually emphasize the awareness more than Sayadaw's practice. In my understanding of what Sayadaw is teaching, this is kind of it's like a middle ground. We are interested both in the awareness and in the objects. We're not like turning around and trying to look at the awareness, not just turning around and saying, oh, this is awareness. It's more of a stepping back and knowing the awareness and what awareness is aware of simultaneously. So that in Sayadaw's practice, there were times when I found I would be practicing with him in Burma, and I would find there'd be times when the mind would just start being more aware of the awareness. And the first few times that happened, it's like, wow, that's pretty cool. And you know, it feels so equanimous and so easeful, and this must be what he's talking about. This must be what I'm supposed to be doing. And then I would give myself a headache trying to do that. And I'd go report to him and say, I got a headache trying to do this. And he'd say, don't try to do that. He said, you know, just notice when the awareness is interested in the objects and when it's interested in the awareness. The mind has this capacity to kind of step back and know the awareness, and the mind has the capacity to be interested in the object. It will do both, and as we begin to get the flavor, that we begin to understand what it means for the mind to know the awareness, which is something that is not very taught in our culture, so it's not something that we tend to be so familiar with. So as we begin to recognize it, we begin to see, oh, it does go back and forth. And the mind begins to kind of orient towards where is it most helpful to be aware right now. So then there are other practices that more emphasize kind of stepping back into the awareness, maybe more the sense of aware of the knowing quality of experience. But again, in an open style, not directing the attention. So I guess just that I'll just kind of leave it there and recap by saying, in general, open awareness practice is this non-directing of the attention. But there's many different kind of flavors of that. It might be that the attention has kind of been tuned to pick up objects or tuned more to towards the awareness or the knowing quality of the mind, or maybe as with Sayadaw's practice, somewhere in the middle of that, where there's a flexibility of moving from one to the other. So I hope that speaks to that question. Tips on being aware of delusion. This is one of my favorite topics. First, it's helpful to have some information about what delusion is, how it works. We can reflect on a few different flavors of delusion or kinds of delusion, perhaps, levels of delusion, maybe. The most obvious kind of delusion is the kind of delusion where we're kind of checked out, not connected, disconnected from experience. This is basically non-mindfulness. When we're lost in thought, caught in a daydream, lost in spaciness. But again, it is not inherently those states, the thought, the daydream, the spaciness, that are non-mindful. The delusion is in the not being aware in the moment that this is what's happening. Oh, spaciness is what's happening. Daydreaming is what's happening. So the delusional quality of mind there, the piece that is the delusion is the non-awareness. This is the grossest kind of delusion, I would say. We are just not aware. So much of our lives have been lived in this way, and so much, you know, looking out at the world, so much lives are lived just not aware. And so this is a dangerous form of delusion, yet it is the easiest one to start to see, and the best place to begin to get a flavor for that quality of the mind that is not aware is that moment when mindfulness returns. So mindfulness returns, and in that moment that mindfulness returns, we get a taste of, we see what awareness is now. And again, it doesn't matter. We're waking up into spacing out. Aware of that quality of drifting, for instance. That first question, aware of the drifting quality of mind. In that moment, then there's both the recognition of awareness is back and the possibility of being aware of that state, that drifting state, that daydreaming state, that spacey state. So there's the possibility of seeing, oh, this is being aware in that state. And in that moment that mindfulness returns, we begin to see the difference between the state of the drifting or the daydreaming or the spaciness or whatever it is, and the quality of the mind in just the moments before, when we were not mindful. Because when mindfulness returns, it's like there's the lingering flavor or scent of what it was like for the mind to not be present in the moments before. So there's that. As the mindfulness returns, there's the kind of recognition of what it was like for the mind to not be present in the moments before. So we get a taste of that quality of non-awareness in the moment when mindfulness returns. Kind of just in the, you know, the this moment of mindfulness has, there's the kind of the memory of what it was like in the moments before. And so that's a way that we can begin to get the taste of that kind of the mind that's just letting go of being aware. In that moment when mindfulness returns, that getting familiar with that flavor, and it's not something, and it's not like you're looking backwards and saying, well, what was it like? It's almost more like in this moment of awareness arising, there's just this lingering scent of what non-awareness was like. So you don't have to like try to look back for it. It's there in this moment of awareness arising. And that lingering scent then can help us to kind of start to get familiar. This morning, we talked a little bit about, you know, noticing when awareness gets lost. So that kind of familiarity with the quality of the mind that's just a little bit like disconnecting from experience. The mind letting go of being with experience. We can start to see the mindfulness kind of weaken or get wobbly or get a little diffuse, or, you know, again, none of these things mean that we're not mindful, but they can be that kind of edge where the mindfulness is weakening. And so we can start to get familiar with that flavor of less mindful. There can be just a sharp drop off, but more often there's a little bit of a sign when the mind starts to wander, a little bit of a kind of like, oh, drifting out sideways. So that's beginning to get that flavor of delusion. We're beginning to get a taste of that feeling of non-mindfulness around the edges of mindfulness, basically. So mindfulness is here. It gets lost, and we start to get familiar with the way that the mindfulness kind of weakens there. Mindfulness is not there. It re-arises, and we get familiar with the flavor of that quality of the non-mindfulness as the mindfulness comes back. So that's one piece, looking at that kind of most obvious kind of delusion. And then another kind of delusion. This is maybe more connected with our own personal conditioning, our own beliefs and views and ideas about who I am, what I do, what people are, how people are supposed to interact. Based on our own conditioning, we have some views about what's good, what's bad, what's right, what's wrong, what's better, what's worse. And so these views, you know, based on conditioning, when these views are not seen, and you know, we can kind of see this, in some ways it's easier these days to begin to see this kind of view as a view, because there's so many different cultures that come together. You know, we're not in a monoculture. Here, even in this country, there's a lot of different cultures. And so, you know, traveling also can give you the flavor of, wow, I thought it was just like, this is how you met somebody, you know, like when you met somebody you didn't know, then, you know, you make this kind of eye contact, and you know, this kind of physical contact is not permitted when you're first meeting someone, you know, so certain kind of rules of engagement that in our own culture we just take as like, this is how human beings do it. But then we go to another culture and it's like, there's a different set of rules here. So we have a whole set of views that we live with based on our social conditioning, our personal conditioning, our societal conditioning, our cultural conditioning. So there's a whole set of views that are at play here. And holding these views to be reality or the way things are, truth, how things are supposed to be, you know, having views, having ways that we engage with each other is not a problem. But the problem or the suffering really happens when we attribute truth to those views, attribute inherent reality, this is the way it's supposed to be, to those views. And actually a lot of suffering. This is not some theoretical, like, you know, some kind of minimal suffering in the world. Huge kinds of suffering come from these views. So, you know, the idea or the view in the dominant culture in this country that if you work hard enough, you can achieve your dreams. You can get what you want. You can live your views, your goals. You can get what you want. Perhaps works for a segment of the population with a certain level of privilege, but ignores or doesn't take in the truth of different backgrounds and different ways that people have been oppressed and treated. The whole kind of sense of white privilege is one of these views, that kind of blindness around the privilege of being white, and that isn't this just the way it is? Aren't I supposed to be able to do these things? Isn't this the way it is for everybody? Well, no, it's not. And so this kind of views about race, about gender, about sexuality, about sexual identity. People hold views about that, being right, wrong, good, bad, better, worse, and suffering is enormous. The people with the benefit of having power can essentially impose their structure, their views on the broader population. So it's really important for us to begin to recognize our views. You know, and we can see little things of this, you know, maybe in certain ways, like when we see somebody do something in the dining hall, there may be some kind of like belief or view that's in there. It's like, well, oh, that's what that person is doing. Well, we don't know what they're doing. We see something external, some action, and we attribute a whole motivation and a whole like trajectory of action to that situation based on our own history, our own conditioning. And so, you know, to begin to recognize, well, what's actually being seen and what's assumption? This is a way that we can begin to kind of puncture some of these, or at least to begin to see these are views and beliefs rather than this is just the way it is. This is truth. So, you know, beginning to expose a good question, and this is true even of what we look at and see of our own experience. You know, we have views about who we are, what we're capable of, based on our conditioning, that are just views. I'm no good. I'm a failure. A self-fulfilling prophecy for myself. And beginning to recognize this is a thought, and a thought that's being believed. So this exploration around views and beliefs is a really interesting place for exploring delusion, because a bunch of delusion manifests in this realm of views. We're holding a view. We don't see it's a view. There is awareness. In this case, this kind of delusion does not mean we're not mindful. It means that we are mindful with a perspective that we're not seeing, or that we're not recognizing is a perspective. And so the idea isn't necessarily to get rid of the perspectives, but to recognize this is being seen from a perspective. And so a question that can be really useful when you are aware from time to time, and it's a way in essentially to a form of attitude, is what is being believed right now? What is being believed right now? And you know, you may not see the answer immediately, and it's, again, it's not to try to figure it out or think about it, but it's more to put into the mind the possibility that a view is informing, a belief is informing the experience. It's kind of like, okay, what's being believed right now? There is something being believed. So kind of allowing that to become one of those curiosities, something I might not have seen before. Oh, views, beliefs at play. And, you know, sometimes with respect to our own self-beliefs, for myself, the self-hatred experience, that whole pattern in the mind, which was so deeply conditioned, was associated with a lot of thoughts and beliefs, and the belief you're a failure, you're no good, you can't do this, you get this wrong, those kinds of thoughts arising in the mind. And, you know, when those kinds of thoughts are coming, it can be helpful to recognize, okay, yep, that's being believed right now. But not necessarily to try to tell yourself to not believe it, because those beliefs come from very deep. And in a way, telling myself, oh, you know, I don't have to believe that anymore, or I don't need that view anymore, is almost giving that belief some power by it's kind of a repression. It's kind of a kind of trying to sidestep it in a way. And there are times that we need to sidestep it, but not with a repression, more with the sense of, yep, okay, that's there, that is being believed, and that's taken me into that rabbit hole, so let me turn my attention elsewhere. But the kind of recognition, okay, that's being believed. This is the thought, and it's being believed, and the thought is one thing, and the believing is another thing. It's like the thought comes up, and then this whole believing process jumps on its back and says, "Oh, yep, there's that thought. Yep, I believe that. Yep, that's true. Yep, that's really true," and the level of belief escalates. And so sometimes with the beliefs too, we can kind of check in. It's like, okay, there's that. There's a belief, and how much do I believe it right now? This begins to kind of puncture some of the sense of the truth of that belief, because sometimes we see, well, I don't actually believe that so much right now. Or maybe, no, I'm really on board for that right now. That seems really true right now. So that's acknowledging what's going on in the mind. But just the acknowledgement, this is a belief, it's like gives a little bit of a space around the pattern for the mind to kind of take in that it is a belief and that it's not necessarily fact. So it gives the mind a little bit of space around those beliefs to just acknowledge, yep, that's being believed right now. We don't have to disbelieve them. In fact, sometimes I think that action to disbelieve kind of reinforces that belief. It's giving it some credence to try to disbelieve it. So that's kind of a second level of delusion. And the third level of delusion is the most powerful, the most potent, and the deepest. You could call it human delusion. We all share this. This middle level of delusion, we all have our own kind of views that we're kind of operating with. In this deeper level, we share a whole bunch of different delusions that we just kind of come into the being human with. We tend to take what is impermanent to be permanent. We tend to take what's unreliable to be reliable as a place for lasting happiness. We tend to take what is not self as self. So I don't have time to go into this in depth right now. 2 minutes for this. So maybe I'll pick it up another afternoon. But what I will say is that, so, you know, talking about how to be aware of delusion, that's the question. How can we be aware of delusion? So talked about that a little bit with each of the other two, you know, noticing that quality of the mind not mindful and becoming aware of views and beliefs as views and beliefs, recognizing when we are believing it. This is becoming aware of the deluding power of the mind. With this more human delusion, the first thing we do is get a little bit of information. Like, yeah, there's nothing permanent. We kind of know that, but still operate as if things are permanent. Things are not reliable. Again, we still operate as if they are. The whole like notion of anger or aversion, I've got to get rid of that thing in order to be happy. It's like the aversion itself is like the wanting to separate from something, that pushing away that separation quality. The delusion that's connected with that is the belief that doing that separation will lead to happiness. So the aversion, the greed, has a deeper delusion that were it not for that delusion, the aversion and the greed would just not happen. So the delusion is really the fundamental place where suffering comes from, those misunderstandings. And we start by hearing a little bit of information, being encouraged to look at our experience from this human perspective, and we start to see occasionally, wow, that thing I thought was permanent actually isn't. This way that I took myself to be this 40-year-old analytical person who had the right answer, that vanished in a split second and is now a 2-year-old, like really happy about seeing a truck. In an instant, a shift of sense of self. We start to see directly with experience the impermanent, unreliable, not self nature of experience. So we hear about it. We are encouraged to watch our experience. And then we see something. We get a sense of, yeah, it doesn't make sense to cling to that. And it's like, it seems so obvious. It's so clear in that moment. It feels like, yeah, figured that one out. Never going to suffer that way again. And then, you know, 5 minutes later, wait a minute, I guess it wasn't so obvious. I'm clinging to that again. So this is part of how we start to be able to recognize delusion at work. We have these moments of understanding and insight and clarity of wow, clinging is suffering. Viscerally, we understand that. And then habits return and we are clinging again. Now that we've seen the absence of that clinging, we can now know this clinging is based on delusion. And so we can start to understand that delusion, that this is delusion at work. We may not be able to see through this delusion right now, but we know it is delusion because we have seen the clarity. We have seen the unreliability. We've seen the way clinging leads to suffering, whatever, however it is that we've seen through something. And so the practice leads us to these moments of clarity and these insights and understandings where we are free of delusion for moments or minutes or maybe even hours occasionally. And then the delusion comes back. But because we've seen without that delusion, now we can know this is delusion. This is the mind just making up its stories, viewing things in a distorted way. So that's how we can start to be aware of delusion, this deepest kind of delusion. It almost takes a stumbling into non-delusion and then seeing the delusion come back to start to be aware of this deepest kind of delusion. So it's time to stop. Let's just take a moment of silence.